hallway toward the office. Harper, then. He'd returned from the hospital and was now going to catch up on his paperwork. Melanie crept up the old wooden stairs, cracked the door, and seeing that the coast was clear, sneaked into the foyer. Seconds later, she stood in front of the hallway mirror, dusting off her hands, her denim shorts, and blue and yellow top. She could hear Harper banging around in his study. From the sound of it, he was not in a good mood. She surveyed her reflection one last time and decided, what the hell? Her father was never generous when backed into a corner. But sometimes, on his own, he'd been known to reach the independent conclusion that he was wrong. She could start with her own apology, see what he would do. It was worth a shot. Melanie walked into her father's office. She expected to find Harper in green surgical scrubs hunched over his desk. She found William Sheffield, surrounded by flying papers and holding a gun. William was having a bad day, a bad week, a bad life. But he was coming out on top of this mess at whatever the price. He just needed proof. Surely Harper had some financial record somewhere. William? A female voice called from the doorway. What are you doing here? William stilled, turned slowly. He saw Melanie standing in the doorway, with her hands stuck in her back pockets. Her gaze rested on his gun warily. William? She asked again.
You shouldn't be here, Mel,
he said. He thought the house was empty. He thought it would be a simple in and out. But now she'd seen him and sweet Melanie always told Daddy everything. He couldn't have that. What are you doing, William?
Enjoying your house.
He gestured at the expensively paneled and decorated room.
Quite the place. I've always wondered what it would be like to come home to this day after day. Who'd have thunk my mama would have been kinder if she'd drugged me up and dropped me off at an emergency room?
You need to leave, Melanie said coolly. Harper's not here right now, so you shouldn't be in his office.
Well, you know what?
William strode toward her, catching her off guard and making her gaze flicker once more to his gun.
I don't give a flying fuck what you think. You're just Harper's adopted daughter and you don't know jack shit.
William! She tried to retreat. He knew she'd never seen him as a threat before, but now he charged and had the satisfaction of seeing her gaze widen with fear. Too late. William pinned her against the wall.
Move away, she said.
Why, Mel? I've already seen all of you. Already had all of you.
Damn it, William!
He grabbed her hair and yanked. She yelped and immediately blinked back tears. She'd always liked to play tough, play cool. William decided it was time for a little change, time to finally have some fun at Harper's expense.
Getting it yet, Mel?
I don't know.
Of course you don't. You know, for a supposedly smart woman, you don't know shit about your family. Yeah, that's right. Stare at me defiantly. Try to think you're better than me. You're not better, Mel. You're just more naive. After all, I figured out your father in less than 5 minutes, and you still haven't a clue after 20 fucking years? Who's so smart now?
He yanked her hair again cruelly. This time she couldn't suppress the hiss of pain. He liked that.
Your fine daddy thinks he has me beat,
William drawled.
He thinks he can set me up to take the fall for all his little illegal operations, and I'd be too stupid to figure it out.
Yeah.
You don't know about that either, do you, Mel?
William swept the barrel of the gun casually around the study.
See all this, sweetheart? Tainted. Your daddy may be the best cardiac surgeon in Boston, but he knows nothing about money. Man digs himself in deeper and deeper all the time. But do you think that means he cuts back, keeps his family in any less style? Oh, no. Not the great Harper Stokes. He simply concocts a plan to slice open innocent old folks and slap pacemakers in their chest. Nobody gets hurt, he likes to say. Insurance companies can afford it. Now, how is that for class, Melanie? How is that for your dear old dad?
Her lips trembled. But then Melanie looked him in the eye and stated in that cool tone he hated so much,
I don't know what you're talking about.
He rewarded her brave words by slapping her hard. She didn't wince, which disappointed him, but her bottom lip cracked. Flecks of blood appeared. The lip began to swell. William said,
Well, say goodbye to Daddy, darling, because I have no intention of coming home to another surprise gift. You get what you deserve, my ass. I spotted that FBI agent at the hospital. I know what the hell he's up to, and I sure as hell am not going to take the fall.
Oh my God. You got a note.
A note?
He frowned at her angrily.
I didn't get a note. I got a goddamn message scrawled across my mirror in blood. Who would have thought your father had it in him?
Melanie was shaking her head.
But how are you connected with Russell Lee Holmes? Did you know Megan?
What?
William didn't know what she was talking about and didn't care. He shut her up by pressing his body against hers, watching her gaze flicker more frantically.
You want to know the truth, Mel? I'll give it to you straight, you dumb little fool. Your father is a con man who would rather slice open healthy people than admit that he's broke. Your mother is an unstable lush who can't keep her own husband satisfied. And your brother is a fucking fruitcake who can only get it up for men. And to top it all off, your godfather is little more than a dressed-up thug. Now how is that for a sweet family portrait? Two criminals, a lush, and a fag. And what does that make you, Melanie? It makes you a patsy. The world's biggest patsy. Con for over 20 years. How do you like that?
William smiled. Melanie's chin came up like she wanted to fight. But he could also read doubt in her eyes. A bit of pleading, as if she wanted him to take the words back. Like hell. He leaned back and casually smacked her across the face.
How dare you dump me like that, you stupid bitch! How dare you treat me like shit!
She cried and tried to knee him. He blocked her easily. Then he reached down, caught her wrists, and began to squeeze.
I need the combination for the safe, Melanie. I need all of Harper's papers.
I don't know it!
He let go of her wrist and pistol-whipped her. Her head hit the wall, then she slid down to the floor, her eyes blinking groggily.
Larry Digger.
What are you talking about? I want the combination for the safe.
Did my father shoot Larry Digger?
William shook his head.
I don't even know what you're talking about. Harper's into money, not murder. Now I want that combination.
What happened to Megan?
She murmured.
What did they do to Megan?
Forget fucking Megan! Give me the combination or I'm gonna kill you!
He wrapped her long hair around his left hand and in one quick tug, jerked her back up to her feet. And the rest simply happened. Sweet Melanie Stokes drove her shoulder into his gut. Air whooshed out of his lungs. She slammed the broad part of her hand into his sternum and stomped on his foot.
Fuck!
He hopped back, cursing and finally getting the gun between them.
Fuck you!
He heard himself screaming.
I'm gonna kill you, bitch! I'm gonna fucking blow your brains!
Stop it!
She gasped, gripping his hand, wrestling for control. The gun went off with a blast. They froze in the middle of the torn-up study. William's eyes were wide, startled. Melanie gazed at him with equal shock as he slowly slipped to the floor. Now she could see the hole in his gut. Blood was pouring everywhere. It was on her hands, on the papers, on the floor. Just like Larry Digger, she thought.
Mi Dios,
a voice breathed in the silence. Melanie turned to find Maria standing in the doorway holding bags of groceries.
I didn't mean to,
Melanie began weakly. Maria whirled and ran. Belatedly, Melanie realized she was still holding the gun in her hands, and her arms were splattered in blood. All she'd ever wanted was a family. People who would love her. People who would be there for her. A place that would finally be home. Lies and blood. Lies and blood. Her body moved on its own. She grabbed her purse. She burst out of the front door of her house. She started running, and she didn't stop. 25. Larmore was ripping new assholes for his investigating agents when David's beeper went off.
Gotta take this,
David said calmly and left the conference room. Larmore grumbled something unkind, but David ignored him. The number on his beeper was not one David recognized, but his call was picked up immediately. The sound of background traffic and voices filled the line.
This is Riggs,
he said. There was a moment of silence, then he knew it was her.
Melanie.
You lied to me.
Melanie, where are you?
You told me you weren't investigating my family. You told me it was William you were looking into. I bet you slept well that night. The super agent did his job.
Melanie, listen to me. I'm trying to help you.
Fuck you, David Riggs. How dare you lie to me?
How dare you not tell me the truth after everything we went through?
Melanie.
The shooting was accidental, just so you know. William was going to kill me. You can tell that to my family, but I don't know if they'll care. I don't know what they care about at this point. I guess you were right, and I didn't know them at all.
Melanie, tell me exactly where you are. I'll be there in minutes.
No. No more games. No more manipulations. From the very beginning, I've let everyone mess with me. Well, now I'm doing this my way. Goodbye.
The phone clicked. David swore furiously, earning a round of stares. Larimore came out of the conference room, trailed by Cheney.
Riggs,
the supervisory agent warned. David grabbed his coat.
Get Detective Jacks on the line. That was Melanie Stokes. According to her, she just shot William Sheffield.
The Stokes house had suddenly become a very popular place. Two ambulances and three police cars barricaded the front, blue lights flashing and uniformed officers milling. Two TV stations had arrived in camera-mounted vans. The local ABC affiliate was probably not far behind. Between the reporters, the neighbors peering from the doorways and windows, and the tourists who were snapping photos, traffic on the whole four-lane street had ground to a halt. David Riggs yanked over his car one block away and ran the rest, Cheney huffing and puffing at his heels. He'd tried calling Melanie back without success. Then he'd gotten Detective Jacks long enough to be told there had been a shooting, all right, and Boston Homicide had a few questions for their good friends at the Bureau. David flashed his creds to the patrolman. Cheney simply muscled his way through. They followed the stream of crime photographers, homicide detectives, and beat officers to the study at the rear of the house. Patricia Stokes stood in a corner, her thin arms crossed in front of her and a jeweled hand fluttering at the hollow of her throat. She looked confused and frightened, as if the slightest sound would shatter her. Her husband was in the opposite corner, scowling and rumpled. He must have just been called from surgery. He had a green mask down around his neck and his arms akimbo on his hips, the stance belligerent. Jamie O'Donnell occupied the doorway. He had already adopted a careful expression of both concern and distrust.
Of course Maria tried to clean things up, Harper was saying tersely. She's a maid, it's her job. She tampered with a crime scene,
Jacks pointed out, standing in front of Harper. Harper shrugged.
How's she supposed to know that? She thought she was just doing her job.
David saw Jacks' point immediately. The blood was not in a clear puddle or splatter pattern, but instead had been smeared all over the floor, making it hard to interpret the scene. On the perimeter of the streaky mess, the blood formed razor-crisp lines at random intervals, as if it had spread along the edge of pieces of paper. The paper was gone. One could interpret that scene as William being shot, incriminating documents at his feet. Detective Jack seemed to have arrived at that conclusion himself.
If I find out you had anything to do with this, Dr. Stokes, I'll bust your rich hide for interfering with an investigation. Tampering with a crime scene and aiding and abetting. Just so you know.
Harper smiled tightly.
You do that, detective, and my lawyer will eat your badge for lunch.
Please, Patricia interjected in a tremulous voice. Can you tell me what happened to Melanie? Where is my daughter? Is she all right?
We're still looking for her, ma'am.
I'm sure she didn't do this on purpose, she continued desperately. There was no reason for her to hurt William.
We don't know that.
Harper glanced at his wife wearily.
After that scene yesterday. Face it, Pat, our daughter is obviously very troubled these days. Maybe she took the end of her engagement with William much harder than either of us thought. I don't know.
Harper! Patricia exclaimed.
She's been having migraines and not sleeping well. She didn't even come home the night before. I'm not going to lie to these people. You and I don't know a thing about our children anymore.
David wasn't thinking. One moment he was standing beside Cheney, listening to Harper incriminate his own daughter. The next moment he was across the room, grabbing a fistful of Harper's scrubs and shoving the startled surgeon against the wall.
Don't you set her up for this, David growled. You don't give a rat's ass about this investigation. William's death is the best thing to happen for you and your little operations. God, this is just a game to you, isn't it? You could have gotten her killed. Do you hear me? You almost got your daughter. Killed. Again. Damn it,
Harper spluttered.
Let me go.
Easy there, O'Donnell said softly from behind David.
Easy there, sport.
Slowly, David became aware that the only person in the room surprised by what was going on was Patricia Stokes. Harper, who was being strangled by a man he'd met only as a waiter, was not surprised. Jamie O'Donnell, faced by two men he'd never seen before, was not surprised. They knew. They knew who David was and who Chaney was, and probably more about the investigation than the federal agents did. David released Harper. He stepped back briskly and split his gaze between Harper and Jamie.
"How?"
David asked. Both men gave him blank looks.
"No,"
David said, shaking his head.
"I don't buy it. I don't think even you two realized what Sheffield would do when pushed too hard. I bet you figured he was a spineless shit just like we did. But he came up with his own agenda, didn't he? Did the stupid thing and put everything in jeopardy. In fact, the only person today who's shown an ounce of common sense is Melanie, isn't it? She's outplaying you. Outplaying us all."
A muscle spasmed in O'Donnell's jaw.
"Don't know what you're talking about, sport." "Sure you do. Congratulations on putting your goddaughter in danger. It's not every day a man almost gets a beautiful young woman killed. But then, you must be getting used to that feeling, huh, O'Donnell? By my calculations, this makes two. First your hired gun, and now your hired lackey. I think you're getting old."
O'Donnell's gaze went black, confirming David's stab in the dark.
"Be careful, sport. Be very, very careful."
David just smiled.
"I'd say ditto, sport, because I'm getting smarter every day and a whole lot closer. You know there's no statute of limitations on homicide, don't you? Especially of a little girl. Especially of a poor, helpless little girl who had no idea what you were capable of. I bet she loved her family too, just like Melanie."
He strode for the door. Behind him, he heard Patricia say,
"What's that man talking about? What has happened to Melanie? Has anyone thought to call Brian?"
"By Brian, do you mean Brian Stokes?"
Jax inquired.
"Of course,"
Patricia said, sounding even more bewildered.
"His friend filed a missing persons report 2 hours ago. Seems Brian Stokes went out for a walk 2 days ago and hasn't been seen since."
The news apparently was too much. With a small cry, Patricia fainted. Her husband didn't catch her. Jamie O'Donnell did.
"Would you mind telling me what is going on?"
Chaney panted, barely keeping up with David outside the house. David strode down the sidewalk, his back killing him and the rest of him beyond caring.
"We got a leak. We've never met them before, and yet they knew who we were."
"Shit,"
Chaney said.
"Think Melanie told them?" "Melanie didn't know I was investigating her father."
David reached the car. He yanked open the driver's side door with more force than necessary and climbed in. Chaney rushed to catch up.
"Don't answer to anyone but Larimore at this point. Things are just beginning. They weren't surprised by my comments about Megan either. They knew exactly what I was talking about."
"They were in on it?"
"Up to their eyeballs."
David shoved the car into drive, then frowned.
"Except for Patricia. She had no idea what was going on."
"Yo, where are we going?"
"Brian Stokes' condo, of course. Where else could Melanie have gone?"
David pulled away with a roar. Chaney said after a while,
"You lost it back there. I mean, you lost it. Larimore hears about you going after Harper Stokes like that, you'll be suspended for a month."
David didn't reply. 26. Brian Stokes' condo reminded David of a sterile museum. He and Chaney got the building maintenance man to let them in. Apparently, his services came with the condo fees. Once inside the third-story residence, they found themselves confronted by four rooms filled only with crystal-clear glass, chrome frames, and one black leather sofa.
"There's not even a family portrait on the wall,"
Chaney said.
"He isn't so pleased with his family." "The adopted daughter is grateful for her parents,"
Chaney murmured.
"The older son is dying to give them away. Can you imagine these guys on Family Feud? Only if they were playing opposite the Donner Party."
They drifted from room to room. Not a speck of dust, a streak of lint, or a stray item of clothing. The man could have given David and his brother lessons all those years ago.
"Just beer and yogurt in the fridge,"
Chaney reported.
"No messages on the machine,"
David said, then frowned.
Can you really believe after 2 days there are no messages on the machine? Maybe he calls in and checks them. Those machines let you do that these days. Yeah, maybe.
They gave the condo a second pass. Brian seemed very neat and no frills. A troubled young man, David thought, because no sane person kept anything that sanitized. The maintenance man claimed not to have seen any blondes entering the building that day, but he also confessed a weakness for daytime soaps. He hadn't seen Brian around. Not that he noticed the male residents much, he said with a shrug, hitching up his slacks and rubbing his beer gut. Some of them were definitely swinging on the wrong side of the field, if you know what he meant, and he didn't want them to get no ideas about him. Chaney and David headed back downstairs. They'd just reached their automobile when a voice stopped them.
Special Agent Riggs. Chaney.
Both agents turned as one, Chaney going for his gun. Brian Stokes stepped out of the shadowed doorway. He looked as if he hadn't slept a minute in days.
You can let go of the gun, Chaney, David said dryly. I don't think Brian Stokes is here for a showdown. I just want to talk,
Brian seconded.
Do you know where your sister is?
Brian shook his head.
I just got a message. That's my role in the family. And was that your role 25 years ago when Megan disappeared?
Brian looked at him curiously.
You think Megan was my fault?
He said and then smiled.
Of course. It's nothing I haven't thought of myself. Brian. Come with me, Agent. There's something I need to show you and something I should have told you. Something I should have told everyone a long time ago.
They followed Brian Stokes on foot, passing block after block of neat brick townhouses lined up like toy soldiers. A few streets over, Brian led them into a narrow street lined with older but still stately and expensive homes. He let himself into the last one with a key. A flower box filled with yellow daffodils waved to them as they passed through the heavy wood door, but none of them noticed.
My friend lives here,
Brian said at last, leading them up the stairs.
You mean your lover? You could say that. In theory, no one knew the name of the man I'm seeing or the fact that I often spend the night at his house. In theory. Tuesday morning, I received a package, hand-delivered to my name, here, at his place.
David and Chaney exchanged looks.
And you've been hiding out ever since?
David asked.
I needed some time to think. And the missing persons report? I asked Nate to do that. To throw him off my trail. Him. I don't know, Agent. I was hoping you could tell me.
They reached the third floor. Brian unlocked the front door and led them both inside, disappearing almost immediately into the kitchen. This condo celebrated hardwood floors, a red brick wall, and piles of suede pillows and soft wool rugs. It was everything Brian Stokes' condo wasn't.
Is Nate home?
David asked. One question was solved. This was definitely Brian's home, and the other residents mere window dressing.
At work, he's the doctor as well. And Melanie, when did you see her?
Brian reemerged from the kitchen, carrying a cardboard box and giving David an impatient look.
I already told you I haven't seen her. But you know William Sheffield has been shot. I checked my machine 30 minutes ago. Two messages. The first was from Melanie. She sounded so calm I almost thought it was a joke. She said William had tried to shoot her, but she shot him instead. She wanted me to know that she was all right. Then she mentioned your name and that you were investigating our father. Probably with good cause. Then she said...
Brian's voice faltered.
She said she knew Russell Lee Holmes hadn't killed Megan. And then she said...
His voice broke again. He cleared his throat forcefully.
She... said that she loved me, and she thanked me for the last 20 years.
Brian's gaze was fixed on the box in front of him. His jaw was tense, and David could see a muscle spasm. Then he got it. Brian didn't just have a small self-confidence issue. He loathed himself. He genuinely loathed himself and held himself responsible for all the bad things that happened in his family, including the fates of his sisters.
You said you had a second message? From my godfather? He's been leaving 3 a day. He also told me about William shooting.
He said he knew something was up and that we really needed to talk about it. Seems that he got a gift, too. I think they all have. They all have. My mom, Dad, Jamie, Melanie, and me. Everyone who was involved back then, though some of us remember it more than others. Let me show you.
He lifted the lid of the cardboard box. There, resting on white tissue paper, was a blackened, shriveled cow's tongue. Brian looked at them both.
It came with a note. You get what you deserve. But I know what it's talking about. I'd already lost my sister, you see. I didn't want to lose my father, too.
David sat down. He got out a spiral notebook and picked up a pen.
Let's start at the beginning here because I'm dying for answers and we got a lot for you to explain. Where were you the day Megan Stokes was kidnapped? What did you and your mother do?
Brian took a deep breath, and then, staring at the dried cow's tongue, he began.
I wasn't a good kid, all right. In this day and age, they'd probably diagnose me with attention deficit disorder. Back then, I was simply hyper and high-strung, and no one, least of all my mother, knew what to do with me. Frankly, our family wasn't sweetness and light back then, either. I don't know how my parents started their marriage, but by the time I came along, my father seemed to be a withdrawn workaholic who gave his best at the office and had nothing left for home. Mom was hurt and sullen half the time, spending money as a hobby, doing anything to get attention. I think I was 8 when I figured out it was worse than that. That Dad wasn't always working late, that Mom knew about the other women and seemed hell-bent on becoming a bit of a party animal on her own. I don't know. It was like being raised by a robot and a 16-year-old. Nobody ever said anything bad about the other. But the undercurrents, when they were both in a room. Kids just know these things, okay?
Yeah, Chaney said heavily, which earned him a surprised look by both David and Brian. He shrugged. Apparently he did know.
Then Megan came along,
Brian continued after a moment.
She was so sweet. Always smiling. No matter what happened, she'd beam and hold out her hands to you. Everyone loved her. Women in supermarkets, for God's sake, the neighbors, stray dogs. If you had a pulse, you automatically loved Megan Stokes, and she automatically loved you. Sure as hell, no one ever thought that about me. And yeah, I was jealous. I'd get angry, but I wasn't immune to her either, Agent. Even when I was jealous, I loved her. Sometimes I even crept into her room at night just to watch her sleep. She was so peaceful, so happy. I never understood how my family could create a little girl who was so happy. And then I would grow afraid. I would think that my parents would ruin her too. She would love them like I did, and they would make her pay. Harper would abandon her, and Patricia would grow bored. And she'd realize one day that her parents were two completely self-centered, overindulged people. I started breaking her toys, stealing her stuff. I kept thinking if I was mean enough, she'd get strong, learn to protect herself. I hurt her, and I still believed I was doing her a favor.
He smiled lopsidedly.
Welcome to the Stokes version of family. And that last day. What did you do then? I had fun, Agent. I honestly enjoyed life for a moment, and that was probably my biggest sin. That day was my 4th therapy appointment. Afterward, the shrink asked to speak to my mother alone. I don't know what he said, but she took me for ice cream, though it was only 11 in the morning. She even had some fun, and this is a woman who's dined on grapefruit and dry wheat toast for the last 50 years. We hung out, Agent. I don't know how else to describe it. After a while, Mom told me that things would be different. The family was having a rough spell, and she understood that they'd been pretending I didn't know what was really going on. She would spend more time with me. She and my father would work things out. She realized now that her family meant more to her than anything, and she was prepared to do whatever was necessary to hold it together. She told me she loved me. She really loved me, and everything would be all right. We played in the park after that. She pushed me on the swing, even though I was too old to be pushed, and I liked it. I remember thinking that I was almost happy, and it was sort of curious and strange. I wasn't sure I'd ever been happy before. Then we went home, and the police officer told us Megan was gone. Just like that. Are you a fatalist agent?
Brian smiled.
I sure as hell am. You were with your mother all day. All day. Did you see Megan get into the nanny's car? No. We left before they did. Brian. Do you know absolutely that Russell Lee Holmes kidnapped Megan Stokes? I honestly thought he had,
Brian said.
I insist. If the devil had a human face, Agent Riggs, it would look like Russell Lee Holmes.
David frowned. He believed Brian Stokes. So if Brian and Patricia were together all day and had nothing to do with Megan Stokes' death...
Then what about the tongue?
He asked in frustration.
If you had nothing to do with your sister's kidnapping, why the gift?
Brian thinned his lips.
I'm not sure. The shrine in Melanie's room caught me off guard. That she might be Russell Lee Holmes' daughter? God, I don't know. All I can say is that there were some things the police didn't catch back then, and someone seems intent on getting out that info now. For example, 3 nights ago my godfather got a penis in a jar. 3 guesses as to why. Him and Patricia. Yep. In spite of what people might think, not all of my parents' problems were caused by Dad's work habits.
Brian shrugged, took a deep breath.
As for the tongue, my father didn't have $100,000 for ransom money back then. He was just an overworked resident still trying to pay off his student loans, let alone keep up with my mother. So Jamie supplied the money. I was there when he arrived with the briefcase filled with $100,000 in cold, hard cash and...
Brian looked up, met their gazes.
And I was there to see that my father did not take that briefcase to the drop site. He took his briefcase instead. Empty. I know because when I spotted Jamie's briefcase under my parents' bed, I pulled it out and opened it. All that cash, sitting right there. Do you get it? My father didn't pay the ransom. He was so damn greedy he kept the money for himself. And Russell Lee Holmes. Russell Lee Holmes killed my baby sister.
Brian's breath came out in angry gasps.
And I never said a word. I never went to the cops or Jamie or my mom or anyone. I just stared at Harper night after night, watching him eat dinner and assure my mom it would be all right. Night after night, he lied through his teeth, sold out my sister for $100,000, and I never had the courage to call him on it. Never. God damn it, I wanted to say it so badly and I couldn't. I just fucking couldn't.
Brian swept the cardboard box off the oak coffee table. It didn't do him any good. The tongue tumbled out, then lay on the rug in plain sight.
Shit,
he said after a moment. Then again.
Shit.
David shared that thought. So Brian and Patricia Stokes hadn't harmed Megan. The family had not rushed into cover-up mode to protect their son. If Megan had been harmed, it had to have been by Jamie or Harper, and it had to have been cold-blooded murder. Of a 4-year-old little girl with big blue eyes and curly blonde hair. He said.
If it's any help. I'm 90% positive that Russell Lee Holmes did not kidnap or murder Megan Stokes. Which may explain why your father didn't take the money to the drop site. He already knew he didn't have to. Come again?
David regarded Brian Stokes seriously.
I don't think your father was after $100,000. I believe he was after $1 million.
What?
The life insurance, Brian. Or didn't you know? Both you and Megan were insured for $1 million.
Brian Stokes hadn't known. In front of them, he went pale as a sheet, then his face twisted with rage.
That goddamn son of a bitch! I will kill him! I can't believe! The ransom note that was delivered was too sophisticated for Russell Lee Holmes. Megan did not fit his victim profile. They never found any physical evidence tying him with the crime. In fact, all they had was his confession. Why would he confess? In order to have his child raised in style. Melanie is Russell Lee Holmes' daughter, Brian. Your parents raised her to cover their own tracks. Now you tell me, for your sister's sake, does that make a difference?
Brian was silent for a moment.
No. Of course not. Melanie is Melanie. She's the best thing that ever happened to this family. Maybe it just figures that it takes the devil's own daughter to love the Stokeses.
David decided to let that comment pass.
Okay. Now you have to help me. Originally, we had reason to believe you or your mother might be involved. You understand that in 75% of cases, it is the family. So we have to think that way. Now we know you and your mother had alibis. What about Harper?
He worked. At least I thought he was at work.
I don't know. A father can be a cold SOB, but I can't imagine him kidnapping. Killing.
Brian shook his head.
He's not the type to get his hands dirty. Yeah? Well, what about Jamie O'Donnell?
Brian hung his head, which was answer enough.
He loved us. I'd swear to it. He played with us, brought us presents, spoiled us, indulged us. But...
He whispered.
But there's more to him than that. He's done some things. Known some things. I get the impression. If Harper hates getting his hands dirty, then Jamie is most at home in the muck. He's that kind of man,
David said.
Yeah, maybe. But Megan was just a little girl. I can imagine Jamie taking on a grown man, or maybe somebody who'd wronged us, but I can't see him hurting a child. Especially Megan. Did you know that his name was the first word she learned to say? Dad was furious. Let's approach this from a different angle,
David tried after a moment.
We have two different things going on here. We have the person or persons who harmed Megan Stokes. Most likely Harper or Jamie. Then we have someone who knows the truth, who seems intimately aware of what everyone did or didn't do 25 years ago. This person is trying to get out the truth, in a sick and twisted way. Maybe, if we can identify this person, we can cut to the chase and ask directly. Who knew that you saw the ransom money but didn't tell?
Ryan shook his head.
I didn't think anyone knew. If I thought I'd had an ally anywhere, I would have confessed.
David gave him a look.
That's not possible. Someone had to have seen to know to send you this cow's tongue. No kidding. And I'm telling you, Agent, no one knew.
Russell Lee Holmes,
Cheney said excitedly.
He must know all the details. That Harper never delivered the money, that the family had a love triangle. Before he confessed, he probably demanded all the details. He's sick and twisted enough to enjoy a little game like that.
Russell Lee Holmes is dead,
Brian said flatly and with a trace of vehemence.
I watched it. Things can be switched. Faked. Maybe it was part of the deal.
Cheney shrugged again.
Why should we assume he did it solely for his child's future? Maybe he got away for life, huh?
David gave the rookie a look.
We have no proof that Russell Lee Holmes is alive. We have proof we're missing some piece of the puzzle,
Cheney argued.
You can't deny that. Let's get back to the facts,
David said flatly.
One, someone knows what happened 25 years ago and is intent on shaking things up. Maybe he guessed about Brian and the ransom money. He also had to know where Megan's toy horse and clothes were all these years. So he has to be connected to the family. Hell, maybe it's William Sheffield. Maybe Harper got drunk one night and said too much, and William thought this would be a great way to twist everyone for extra money. We'll have to search his place. That brings us to the person who actually did the crime 25 years ago, and is desperate to keep it covered up. He hired the shooter to take out Larry Digger when he got too close, and Melanie when she began to remember.
What?
Brian said sharply. David filled him in.
Whoever is doing this,
David concluded,
is playing for keeps. I think, Dr. Stokes, that having Nate declare you missing might not have been such a bad idea. And I'm asking you again, understanding now that Melanie is in danger, that we are dealing with someone who murdered a 4-year-old girl, do you know where she is?
No, Agent. I just got her message.
Okay. She knows she isn't safe at home, She knows she couldn't find you. She's not experienced enough or prepared enough to drop off the face of the earth. So where would she turn next?
Brian's face lit up.
Aunt Margaret, her boss at the Dedham Donor Center.
It was a 35-minute drive to the Dedham Red Cross Donor Center. Chaney handled the wheel. David worked the cell phone. He offered Detective Jax the tidbit that Melanie had left a message on her brother's machine, saying she had to shoot William in self-defense. In return, Jax told him that they had witnesses testifying that Melanie had used a payphone in Government Center. They had one forensics team already searching the area for the murder weapon. They'd also found the taxi driver who had driven Melanie to Brian's condo. He'd described Melanie as being pale, quiet, and a little spooky. Now the police were canvassing the neighborhood, talking to taxi dispatch stations, monitoring the airport, and getting financial records from her bank. They figured they'd turn up something shortly. How long could one debutante hide? David said uh-huh a lot. He didn't bother to mention his current destination. FBI agents were supposed to cooperate with local law enforcement, but that didn't preclude staying one step ahead of them. They pulled into the parking lot of the Red Cross Center a little after 3. Melanie had now been on the run for over 2 hours. Plenty of time to get down to Dedham by taxi or train. They found Anne Margaret inside the vast white blood donation center, sitting in a tiny office doing paperwork. The desk looked makeshift, the plastic chairs utilitarian, industrial metal bookcases and gray metal filing cabinets. The woman fit the office. Short, sensible gray hair capped closely in tight curls. Lined face carrying the permanent stamp of a southern sun. Trim, neat figure clad in nurse's whites. Though not large or imposing, Anne Margaret looked like the kind of woman you could trust to get the job done. At their approach, she glanced up, frowned, then paled as they showed their credentials.
"What is it?"
she asked sharply, as if part of her had been expecting bad news for quite some time.
"What happened?" "We'd like to ask you some questions about Melanie Stokes,"
David said. The lines of her face turned to confusion. Apparently the presence of FBI agents didn't surprise her, but FBI agents asking about Melanie did. David motioned to 2 yellow plastic chairs.
"May we?"
Anne Margaret was too well-mannered to refuse, so he and Chaney took a seat.
"I don't understand what you need to know about Melanie,"
Anne Margaret said, setting down her pen.
"She's not even scheduled to work today." "She's volunteered here for a while?"
David asked.
5 years,
Anne Margaret frowned.
"Is she all right? What's going on?" "Do you know William Sheffield?"
"Yes. Melanie's ex-fiancé. Now see here." She leaned forward, her lips thinning into a firm line. "I want to know what is going on."
"William Sheffield was found shot 2 hours ago. We have reason to believe that Melanie pulled the trigger."
Anne Margaret was shaken. "No," she whispered.
"Yes, ma'am."
But, she couldn't seem to find her bearings. Her hands fluttered on her desk as if seeking anchor. "Is he dead?"
"Yes, ma'am. But we'll need you to keep that under your hat until we notify his family."
"He doesn't have a family. He was an orphan, too. It was one of the things he and Melanie had in common."
"What do you know about their relationship?"
And Margaret still looked shell-shocked. "I don't. I mean, Melanie is more than just a volunteer. I'm her friend. I remember how happy she was when he first proposed." David waited patiently. "Her father introduced the two of them, I believe. They dated 6 months, seemed happy. I know Melanie said once that William was a bit jealous that she'd been adopted by such a rich family and he hadn't. She didn't understand that. He'd become a doctor after all, lived a very good life. I guess it caused a rift between them. She hasn't really talked much about him since they broke up. I assumed the parting was mutual."
"Did she ever allude that she wanted him back or felt injured?"
"Not at all. And even if..." "Listen to me, young man." Anne Margaret pulled herself up. "William and Melanie weren't a good match, but you don't kill someone over something like that. William was a really nice boy. Very smart, a good anesthesiologist. And Melanie simply wouldn't hurt a fly. Plus, their breakup is ancient history. There must be some other explanation."
Did she talk to you about anything else going on in her life?
Well, I haven't really spoken to her for 4 or 5 days. She hasn't been feeling well. Problems with migraines.
Her voice trailed off. She seemed to realize that could be significant. David waited, but Anne Margaret had obviously decided it would be best if she didn't say anything more.
We really need to speak to Melanie,
David said evenly. I'm sure you do.
If you know where she is.
I don't know any such thing.
You're sure she hasn't contacted you?
I am her boss agent, not her mother.
David said in a low, steely voice.
If we find out you're hiding a fugitive?
But Anne Margaret remained unmoved. If she did know more, she simply wasn't saying. David placed a business card on her desk. The blue FBI shield emblazoned on the card stared up at her as he and Chaney walked away. As he was passing through the doorway, David suddenly turned.
Ever hear the name Angela Johnson?
He thought she flinched.
No.
What about Annie?
A muscle flickered in her cheek. My name is Anne Margaret Dawson. That's all I go by, agent.
At least on a good day. Of course.
She smiled thinly.
Of course.
David and Chaney walked out.
What do you think?
Chaney asked as they got into their car.
I don't know yet. She seemed to take the news rather hard.
David tapped the steering wheel a few times, then started the engine.
I think she may be worth watching. I don't know. Melanie Stokes is spooked and frightened. If you were spooked and frightened, would you really run to Dedham? No. But if my name was really Anne Margaret Dawson, I wouldn't flinch at the mention of Angela Johnson. Who's Angela Johnson? Russell Lee Holmes's wife.
Chaney's eyes got round.
You think? Anne Margaret, Annie, Angela. Lots of Anns to be a coincidence. And she's from Texas, and she's about the right age.
Oh my God, Chaney said. David just nodded and drove. He had 1,000 things on his mind, but first and foremost, he remained worried about Melanie. Chaney didn't speak again until they were almost in Boston.
Shit,
he declared.
Riggs were male chauvinist pigs. Probably. Think for a moment. The Stokes family doesn't have motive to stir things up. We don't think O'Donnell has motive to stir things up. Melanie certainly doesn't. And you're determined to believe that Russell Lee Holmes is dead. Yes, I definitely believe that. So what about Russell Lee Holmes' wife? What about this Angela Johnson and everything she must know from back then? Oh, God,
David said as the pieces started to fit.
We are male chauvinist pigs. She'd probably know all about the details of the crime and life in the Stokes family. That would explain the shrine in Melanie's room. If you were a woman and you gave up your daughter 20 years ago to protect her, to give her a better life, you'd have to wish that she'd remember or someday came looking for you. Christ. First thing tomorrow morning. Everything I can find on Angela Johnson. Anne Margaret Dawson. Got it.
27. David didn't return home until 10 p.m. He felt a moment of apprehension standing in front of his apartment door. Melanie knew where he lived. Would she come here on her own? Give him a second chance? He unlocked his door and pushed it wide open. Moonlight cascaded over the dingy mess that passed for his private refuge, illuminating his old green couch and the dusty collection of trophies he never could bring himself to throw away. No Melanie. Damn. By 8 p.m., the police had traced 2 ATM withdrawals to her checking account. Her bank reported her coming in late in the afternoon and withdrawing an even larger sum of cash. At this point, she had a few thousand dollars on her. She could get pretty far on a few thousand dollars. David wished he knew where. He limped into the kitchen and grabbed a bag of frozen peas. His back was a mess. His career wasn't going so great these days either. The press was all over the shooting of William Sheffield. Reporters were already calling the Bureau's press relations agent, stating they knew 2 FBI agents had been present at the scene, and they wanted to know the Bureau's involvement in the case. So far, Larimore had issued the generic, "We are merely assisting local law enforcement in any way they see fit," a party line nobody was buying.
It would be only a matter of time before someone found out about the investigation into Drs. William Sheffield and Harper Stokes. Then someone would place Larry Digger at the Stokes residence, connect the dots with his recent murder, and the story would gain real momentum, while the Bureau remained looking bad. Agents leaving a trail of unsolved homicides. The Phoebes, always a day late and a dollar short. The potential for Bureau bashing was unlimited. The Bureau had already had enough bad press in the 90s. Larmore had informed Riggs and Cheney curtly after 5 o'clock. They'd better perform some damage control quick, or they would become the first agents in the history of the Bureau reduced to serving as meter maids. David paced his living room. He jerked off his tie, shed his jacket. To hell with Larmore. David couldn't stand not being able to put this case to bed. 25 years earlier, Harper cut a deal with Russell Lee Holmes. Something happened to Megan Stokes, and Harper wanted Russell Lee to take the fall. Harper gets $1 million. Russell Lee's daughter gets a good home. Everyone lives happily ever after until one day, Harper needs money again. This time he comes up with scheme number 2. Slicing open healthy patients for profit. No harm, no foul, he must have thought. Piece of cake after disguising a murder. But he didn't cover up all his tracks this time. And someone was after him now. Maybe he or she wanted vengeance for Megan. Or maybe he or she wanted Melanie back. Or maybe he or she was simply sick to death of Harper Stokes. David sure as hell was. Killing one daughter, adopting another, and leading her on for 20 years, only to hand her over to the police on a silver platter. The man had to have ice water instead of blood in his veins. The phone rang. David quickly snatched it up.
Melanie?
There was a pause.
David?
Not Melanie, but his father. David was disappointed, and he sounded it.
Dad, is everything all right? It's late. Sorry, didn't mean. Just couldn't get a hold of you during the conventional times, you know. Did you get my messages? I've been wondering.
His father sounded humbled and hurt. David grimaced.
I'm fine, he said. Just busy. Work going well.
Bobby's voice picked up.
I got some new ideas for your gun. My gun's fine, Dad. I'm doing some work with Detective Jax. He told me to give you his regards. Oh, Jax. I like him. Good man. Pretty good shot, but you're better. Coming out to the range anytime soon?
Bobby asked eagerly.
I could meet you there. I don't know, I got a pretty rough case now. More of that doctor stuff?
Yeah. The call drifted to silence. David shifted restlessly, cold water trickling down his back. He should say something more. Hey, Dad, how are the Red Sox doing? No, don't tell me. It'll just break both of our hearts.
So, Bobby said presently, your brother is doing better. Sent his lead pitcher to the bench like I recommended. Brought up the rookie. Good kid, lots of potential. Got 10 strikeouts his second game.
That's good.
I painted the house. Gray, dark blue trim. Not that different.
You should have told me, I would have helped.
No need, I have plenty of time. Business is kind of slow right now.
Another edgy silence.
How's your back?
Bobby blurted out.
Fine.
David lied.
Taking those pills the doctor talked about?
Nope. No need.
Lied even more.
David,
Bobby said.
I'm your father. Can't you at least tell me what's going on?
David hung his head, then stared at the big trophy in the back. The state championship. One on the day his father had hugged him so hard, he thought his ribs would break. He hurt. He hurt too much, and it had nothing to do with solidifying vertebrae and spasming muscles. He'd failed his dad. That was the bottom line. He could get over many things, but he couldn't get over that. He said weakly,
I'm just busy, Dad. A lot of work right now. I really should be going. I see. Fraud? Fraud. Homicide. I'm not doing so good at staying ahead of these guys. You'll catch up.
His father sounded confident. David squeezed his eyes shut and said tightly,
you don't know that. Christ, Dad, it's not like I traded in a brilliant pitching career for a brilliant law enforcement career. I'm in healthcare fraud. I read reports, not change the world. As a matter of fact, because of me, some young woman had to shoot a man to save her life today.
Now she's on the run, frightened and scared and God knows what, and it's all my fault.
You'll help her, his father said.
Damn it, listen to me, Dad. Just listen. I don't save lives, okay? Or the world. I save dollars and cents, that's it. I spend most of the year reading hundreds of pounds of subpoenaed documents. I don't need a souped-up Beretta with radioactive sights. I need whiteout. Whiteout!
The phone line fell silent. David realized what he'd just said, how much he'd said. Oh, Christ. He tried to backpedal furiously, though he knew it was too late.
I'm sorry. I'm just working too hard. I'm not getting enough sleep. I don't understand your job, his father said somberly. I try, David, I do. But I'm not book smart like you. I didn't go to college. I'm good with my hands, and I'm good with guns, and I'm good with a baseball. When you were doing that, too, I could understand. Then you got a degree. I mean, a real degree instead of going to college for ball like we thought you would. You got into the academy. God almighty, I can't imagine ever being chosen for something like that. Now you analyze things. You take on doctors and hospitals and insurance companies, and those people aren't stupid. No, David, I don't get your job. I'm just good with my hands, and I'm good at fixing up your gun. Because you won't play ball with me anymore, David. Customizing your Beretta is pretty much all I have left. So that's what I do. I can't advise you, I can't coach you. At the time, I can't even speak to you. So I fix your gun. Maybe that seems silly to you, but I'd rather be silly than completely shut out.
Dad. David didn't know what to say. He should reassure his father, play nice, get off the phone before he made anything worse. And then, strangely, he found himself whispering.
Dad, I failed a woman today. I mean more than professionally. She trusted me. She needed me, and I shut her out. I lied to her and told myself it was all right because of my job. I did something I know you'd never do. I don't know what I was thinking.
His father was silent for a moment. He said quietly,
"You're a good man, David. You know you made a mistake, and now you'll fix it. I'm not even sure where she is. Then figure it out. You're the smartest man I know, David, and I mean that. When the doc told me your condition was hereditary, caused by genetics, I had a bad thought. Made me feel guilty for days, but I think it's still the truth. What? I thought that if one of us was meant to get it, marked for it, then I was glad it was you. You may have had the better arm, but son, you also just had more. Where would Steven be without baseball? What would I do? You, on the other hand, you took after your mother. You got her brains. And now you're an FBI agent, an honest-to-God federal agent. Haven't you ever figured out how envious your brother and I are of you?
David couldn't swallow. He said,
I guess not. You did well, son. You did well.
David couldn't reply. His throat had closed up on him. His dad said.
It's getting kind of late. I know you have a lot of work to do.
Yeah. I'll talk to you soon. Maybe bring in my Beretta. You can play with the sights.
Okay. I'll even bring some whiteout.
David laughed a little hoarsely.
Thanks. Good night, David. Good night.
He hung up. He sat for a while longer in the dining room, feeling a little wrung out, a little reassured. It had been a long time since he'd really connected with his dad. He was 36 years old. He kept telling himself his father's approval shouldn't mean much anymore, but that was a load of bunk. A parent's approval always mattered, regardless of age. He stopped the thought cold. Comprehension washed over him. Melanie Stokes on the run. Melanie Stokes feeling betrayed, as if her whole life had been a lie. Melanie Stokes wanting to know once and for all who she was. He knew exactly where she'd gone. He picked up the phone and roused Chaney out of bed. 28.
Anne Margaret didn't go to sleep. She sat in the shadowed darkness of her little bungalow, still wearing her nurse's whites. She knew he wouldn't arrive right away, but later, when he thought no one was paying attention. The back door finally opened. He walked quietly into the living room, hardly making a sound.
"I guess you heard,"
he said at last. She stared at Jamie from across the room. She realized there was nothing he could say that would make it right. She'd been foolish to wait up for him, but they had been through so much, first as friends, recently as lovers. She'd thought of him as her second chance at happiness. She'd thought she'd finally gotten it right. This time love would be kind. She'd forgotten that she always fell for the wrong kind of man.
"I'm sorry, my love,"
Jamie finally said softly.
"I am. So sorry."
He took a step forward.
"Don't. Annie, please listen to me. The agents told me Melanie shot him. Why would that happen, Jamie? What could have gone wrong? I don't know, Annie. You can't believe for a minute I wanted this to happen. It's a real shame. I'll do whatever it takes to make it right."
The omnipotent Jamie O'Donnell. Her lips twisted. She finally rose, surprised to find that her legs would support her.
"If I said anything now, after all these years, you would kill me. Wouldn't you, Jamie?" "Don't say that, love. Don't talk like that."
"It's true, though, isn't it? You like to think you're better than Harper, but you're not, Jamie. You both piss on the people you love. Men should spend less time with guns and more time in childbirth." She brushed by him, her steps forceful. He tried to catch her shoulder, and she slapped him so hard the room rang with the blow. The muscle on his jaw twitched. They both knew it was in his nature to always fight back, even when in the wrong. But he checked himself now. He fisted his hands at his sides and weathered the blow for her. She supposed that meant he really did love her. And Patricia Stokes.
"I'm sorry, Annie,"
he said again.
"Go to hell. Even if you hate me, sweetheart, you struck a deal, and I'll expect you to keep up your end. Sold my soul to the devil. 25 years, Annie," he said softly. "Very fine life. Better than you could have done on your own, and you know it. I kept my word. I told you that very first day that Jamie O'Donnell always keeps his word, and I meant it."
Her eyes suddenly filled with tears. The sight struck him more forcefully than her slap. He'd never seen Anne Margaret cry, not once. He'd first respected her steel core, then grown to love that about her.
"Don't,"
he said hoarsely.
"Annie, I loved you,"
she whispered.
"I thought it would make things better. But it only makes them worse. It doesn't have to change, but it does. You've always known, haven't you, that it would come to this?"
For his answer, he tried once more to take her hands. She pulled away.
"I don't want to see you or any of the Stokeses ever again," she declared. "I made a mistake back then. I paid for it, but I won't keep paying for it. You can't mean that. And if anything happens to Melanie," she continued, "I will hunt you down, Jamie O'Donnell. I will kill you with my bare hands. Don't think I didn't learn anything from the company I've been keeping. And don't underestimate me. When men are cruel, it's capricious. When women are cruel, it's serious."
She twisted away from him and stalked down the hall. Jamie watched her go, feeling that tightness again in his chest. In the back of his mind, a little voice whispered he was having a heart attack. The rest of him knew better. His heart was breaking. He'd felt exactly this way the night Patricia walked out of his arms and told him she was going with Harper forever, going to give the bastard one last try. Jamie might be her passion, but Harper, sniveling Harper, was her kind. It didn't change Jamie. It didn't, and for that he was sorry. Now Jamie O'Donnell whispered,
"Don't do anything stupid, Annie, my love. Please don't make me kill you."
Patricia stood in front of the liquor cabinet. She opened the door and took out the nearly full bottle of gin. Her hands moved slowly as if weighed down by 50-pound barbells. She was alone. Her husband was off doing whatever it was he did at odd hours of the night. and she didn't care. She didn't care about anything anymore. And if she had been able to summon any emotion for her husband, it would have been a cold-hearted rage that would have forced her to hurt him once and for all. She stared at the bottle of gin. Don't do it. You don't have to make the same mistakes again. You don't have to fail again. But maybe I do. Did we ever fix any of the problems in this family? Or did we all just run away? Both my husband and my son still carry so much rage. And my daughter, my precious adopted daughter, forced to shoot a man while still carrying the imprint of her father's hand upon her face. The phone rang. She picked it up, uncapping the gin and saying,
What?
Mom? Her son replied evenly.
Brian.
Are you drinking yet? I figured that's what you would do.
Oh, Brian.
She started crying.
I want my baby back. What have they done to Melanie? How could I have lost Melanie?
I want to hate you,
Brian said hoarsely.
Why can't I hate you?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for everything.
She set down the bottle and cried harder.
I'm standing here tonight, figuring this ought to push you over the top,
Brian announced.
And I keep thinking, I shouldn't care. It's not my problem. I can't take care of you. I can't fix things for you and Dad, and I surely never figured out how to make either of you happy. But then I think of Melanie and how disappointed she'd be in me if I did nothing. Damn it, do you love her?
He asked abruptly.
Tell me, do you at least honestly love her?
Completely.
So do I,
Brian whispered, then blurted out.
What did we do wrong this time, Mom? How could we fail twice?
And then he started to cry, too. They cried together in the dark, because they had been the ones who had wanted Melanie. More than Harper, they had been the ones determined to make a fresh start. And in loving Melanie and failing her, mother and son finally found common ground. After a moment, Brian pulled himself together. He told her about Larry Digger's arrival and accusations, about the altar in Melanie's room, then Larry Digger's subsequent murder and Melanie's growing belief that she really was Russell Lee Holmes's child, and that the Stokeses had somehow made a deal.
That's ridiculous,
Patricia stammered. She reached once more for the gin.
Is it?
Her son asked.
Come on, Mom. I know you and Dad were fighting all the time back then, and both of you hate to fight. For God's sake, what could make Dad angry enough to yell?
Her heart thundered too hard. It was unfair, she thought, that a mother would have to expose herself like this to her son.
It was Megan, wasn't it?
He filled in calmly.
You were fighting about Megan.
Yes.
And Jamie.
Patricia closed her eyes. She couldn't say the rest. Her son expelled a breath sharply.
Jesus Christ. She was Jamie's daughter, wasn't she? That's why she was so happy, so pretty. I knew this family couldn't produce anyone so happy. I knew it.
Brian.
He killed her, damn it. Don't you get it, Mom? Not Russell Lee Holmes. The police have proof he could not have killed Megan. It was Dad. He murdered her for the $1 million life insurance, and because he knew she wasn't even his own kid. Oh, God, he destroyed our family because he needed money. And we let him, Mom. We never suspected a thing.
You don't know,
she said desperately.
We don't know.
I saw the fucking ransom money, Mom. That day Jamie brought it over. But Dad didn't take that briefcase.
No.
Yes. I found the real briefcase under your bed. I saw Jamie's money. Dad pocketed it as well, because he knew he didn't really have to pay the ransom, because he knew Megan was already dead.
No, 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 don't say these things. You are his son. How can you say these things? He's always loved you.
He kicked me out of the family.
And he's been trying to reach you for days to let you back in. We're going to Europe. We're going to Europe as one big happy family.
Her voice had risen to fever pitch. She heard herself speak like a raving lunatic and her bravado collapsed. They were not one big happy family. Her own husband had kicked her son out of the family, and had tried to turn her daughter over to the police. He had not paid Megan's ransom. He had known Megan was really Jamie O'Donnell's daughter. Oh God, she had been living with the man who killed her own daughter, and worse. She had loved him. She had been grateful he brought her flowers, grateful for each crumb of attention, grateful that someday he would retire and truly be all hers. Even now she was thinking, poor Harper, you're so desperately afraid of being commonplace, of never rising above your parents. You don't even realize how talented or loved you are. Especially by Melanie. Oh Lord, she was going to be ill.
I won't protect him anymore, Mom, her son said quietly. I can't believe what he's done to us.
He's your father.
Mom, you're an alcoholic, and your own husband keeps bringing home booze. Doesn't that tell you something? I'm going out.